This is Barry Tyker of the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. Today is June 19th, 1998. I'm in the office of Dr. Joshua Lederberg in New York City at his office in at the Rockefeller University. And we're going to be conducting a series of interviews about his early years of his career and life and his career at the University of Wisconsin. Let's begin at the beginning and get a little bit of context for what's to follow. Could you discuss briefly your early schooling, your elementary, high school, a little bit about your family background?
Okay, well, I was born in Montclair, New Jersey on May 23rd, 1925, actually at Glen Ridge Hospital, which is just on the boundary. My folks were living on what is now the wrong side of the tracks, or the non-existent tracks in Montclair. My father had recently emigrated along with his new bride, my mother,
from
Israel, and Montclair was the one place he was able to get a situation through, I think, some remote family connections, both as a Hebrew teacher, part-time rabbi, and supervision of ritual slaughter, the Shatkin, as it's called. I may have that word wrong, sorry, that's another word. He was able to find a more durable position about 6 months later, and the family moved to Washington Heights in Manhattan by the end of 1925, early 26, and that's where I grew up. I went to the public schools in New York. I've commented that they were instruments of mobility, very well calculated to be so, instruments of Americanization. And I fell right in with the movement of the melting pot and a very well-founded view of America as a land of opportunity. I was a precocious child, and this caused some difficulties at a certain stage, but I had some very wise teachers. I never felt I had any but the most sympathetic. And one or two of them would make a contract with me, so they well understood that I was two or three years ahead of the class, but it was not my job to prove how smart I was. They already knew that, but to assist them. And one way of doing that would be perhaps sometimes to sit in the back of the room and do my own work if I was too bored with what was going on in the classroom. Well, that degree of insight and compassion has really always impressed me.
So was that in elementary?
Elementary and middle school, the junior high school. So I had nothing but encouragement. I was a very academically inclined youngster. I was spending all of my time reading. I learned much more from the public library than I did at school, as best I can recall. And likewise, I qualified to enter Stuyvesant High School, which had been founded in 1918 as a special school for science academic development. It was an all-city school. It did not depend on neighborhood.
How did one
representation
qualify
for that? They had an entrance examination, and it was much sought after. The great thing about Stuyvesant was the peer group, as these were the most academically competitive and brightest kids in town. I felt a lot less lonely there than I had as a grade school student, because there were other precocious kids and people I could sharpen wits with. The teachers were good as well, and they were certainly all extremely sympathetic to intellectual nurturance of their students, with very, very rare exceptions. There were a few ressentient individuals, people who had not made it in more advanced academic work and felt a little humiliated that with PhDs and some research background that they were merely teaching high school. I would say those folks were not as good teachers as the ones who possibly didn't have quite as much depth in the content, but were much more sympathetic rather than competitive with the students. Anyhow, there again, I had a very nurturing environment, lots of encouragement, after school clubs and activities. But Stuyvesant also had, unusual for schools at that time, advanced placement courses. So there were a sprinkling of college level courses.
Were all the courses within the school? You didn't go to any colleges?
No, we did it all at Stuyvesant. And that's a tradition that's continued to this day. I would say that half or two-thirds of the students in those days were Jewish second-generation immigrants, as I was. You'll find a similar phenomenon today, except they're all Asians, and they're running away with all the prizes and doing very, very well indeed. So to a certain sector of New York society, that's continued to play that kind of role.
Were there any particular teachers in your high school that played a particular role in your training?
There were some who were spent more time with me and were more sympathetic than most, but I wouldn't say that I had very much overt learning from them. I got that out of the books, but I have some notes and would be reminded of two or three that were particularly helpful and with whom I maintained some contact for years after graduation. So I would say nurturance was the most important aspect of their role, and encouragement, and a little bit of actual guidance, although I was pretty much autodidactic and self-willed about what I was going to get into.
Was it a specific curriculum that you took, or did you have electives?
No, a lot of electives.
What did you focus
chemistry
on?
Chemistry, and some biology, but mostly chemistry.
Did you have a chemistry set at home?
Oh, yeah. Well, when the chemistry set was for grade school kids, we went to Imer and Almond and bought reagent-grade chemicals over the counter, and you'd be amazed what you could get. I mean, a high school kid could buy a kilogram of potassium cyanide that wouldn't blink an eyelash. And I did nearly blow myself up on one occasion when I had, oh, it must have been 100 grams of sodium that one way or another I managed to get plunked into a beaker of water. And of course, there was an explosion. So I did my share of mischief.
What about the role of religion in your early life and in your education?
My father was an Orthodox rabbi, and there was some tension along lines of modernity that I had plenty of sympathy for the fundamental ethical and philosophical traditions of Judaism. I didn't see that they had that much to do with the ritual practices that we were deeply immersed in, that I knew had evolved during the Middle Ages, and were not even part of what might call fundamental Judaism of the Old Testament. And I would sometimes tease my father about why he didn't go back to the fundamentals. But I was eager to be secularized, to be in the American tradition, and there was a certain tension, but also a lot of mutual sympathy. He respected my intellectual interests. Once he was reconciled to the idea that not only was I not going to be a rabbi, but I probably would be straying from routine observance, we were able to discuss a lot of things from our respective positions with mutual respect and affection.
A question I don't generally ask people about the very early part of their career, but you're an exception, is did you have any career aspirations early on?
You asked me about career aspirations. I knew I was going to be a scientist from the time I was literate. My very first composition said so, and I think
we have
a copy
letter
of that
in the files. Just, you were going to be like Einstein and have a few ideas or something like that, solve a few problems.
I think the fact that my mother saved it is as important testimony as the fact that I wrote it. So.
I mean, what happened? You just always thought that way?
Well, there must have been precursors, but I wasn't around at the Big Bang to say very much about the ultimate origins. The best I can trace of this is that this was the alternative to Orthodox religion, that we had folk heroes like Albert Einstein and Chaim Weizmann, who were very deeply respected among Jews, even though they were not deeply observant, who were themselves proud of their Jewish origins and brought credit to the Jewish people. So I think that was very much in the air and must have had more than a little to do with it. And I would read about their accomplishments in the newspapers. And I guess I was starting to do that when I was 6 or 7. Mm-hmm. So that's as much as I can tell you.
That's interesting. When you graduated from high school, you then enrolled at Columbia College. Why did you select Columbia?
Well, partly on false pretenses, in terms of my limited knowledge of optional opportunities, and partly out of opportunity, I didn't realize I'd had any choice from a financial point of view other than City College, and until the very last minute, and I did win a scholarship from Columbia. I had my eye on Columbia because I knew that T.H. Morgan had been there and that E.B. Wilson had been there, and I was a little blurred in my mind as to whether they were still there or not. Of course, they weren't. But they did reflect the traditions of Columbia as a great center of research in biology. I had known about their works while I was in high school. I had very little advice. In fact, I can't remember any at all about choice of colleges. I think, again, our teachers were imbued with the idea that City College was the only possibility. And I had many age peers and others, of course, who went through the City University and had spectacular careers thereafter. I think the difference was that City College had some good teachers. It had a superb peer group, probably best of any to be found anywhere. But they had very limited laboratory facilities, and they didn't have folks. There wasn't much research going on at City College at that time, practically none, in contrast to the active research programs at Columbia. And I was aware of that, and so that was the reason for my preference for Columbia.
You said you won a scholarship. How did that happen? Was it, again, a competition?
It was a competition, but I'm not sure of the detail, but I must have had some advice from my mentors at Stuyvesant. I would not have had any other contact with Columbia. I didn't know anyone who was at Columbia. Now, another imaginable base for that, although I can't really dig out the details, there was another competitive entry into an organization called the American Institute Science Laboratory, which was at the time or later, the American Institute was later incorporated into the New York Academy of Sciences, and they won a grant from Westinghouse and IBM to establish a laboratory for young high school students to have a place that they could actually dabble in some research. They promised some mentorship, which in my experience never materialized, but at least it was a place that you could actually have some equipment, had a microtome and things of that sort to do cytological work. So I was there for quite a while. In fact, I graduated from high school in February of 1941, and I could not enter Columbia College until September. For one, I was too young. They had an age requirement of being 16, two was the mid-year. And I spent most of that spring working at the American Institute Laboratory.
Oh, really?
I marvel that we could afford it. Either that summer or the summer before, I had spent working as a stock clerk at Goldsmith Brothers Stationery Store. So one way or another, I was expected to provide some help for the family budget. We were not dirt poor, but we're hardly well off, and the rabbi often got a lot of gifts in kind rather than payments of salary or whatever. In fact, he supplemented his income out of necessity. I think we would not have survived if it weren't for the weddings at which he would officiate, the unveilings and that sort of thing. And all the family was expected to chip in and help out in those circumstances. Our own parlor was the site of any number of weddings. I remember holding the chuppah, the canopy, when I was a kid, you know, so in a way I was the equivalent of a bridesmaid.
Now, you said you graduated when you were 15. Did you skip any grades in your school?
Oh, yeah, that was routine in New York at that time, so I was 2-3 grades ahead.
When you enrolled at Columbia, did you declare a major immediately, or could you at that point?
Whether it was required or not, it was going to be biology and chemistry, and what I actually did was enroll in a whole set of graduate courses right off as a freshman, and it was just as well. I was not mature enough to really appreciate the humanities and contemporary civilization, which were obligatory for graduation, so I eventually did get to take them.
So you did it sort of upside down.
So I did it upside down. But that was, you might have thought of me at that point as an idiot savant, that I was doing just fine in science, but the rest of my life experience, one might say culture, was not that far ahead of my chronological age. So in retrospect, it was not such an unwise thing to do, although I don't know how well thought out it was. I was just so eager to get into courses. It took some doing to convince the professors that I was up to them, but their doubts didn't linger very long once I was in them. I was not with my age peers. I was with graduate students at the time, from the time I was a freshman. So that was the group I would sort of tail along with the best I could. So I had a rather distorted social life.
Mm-hmm. occasionally we're going to bring in Wisconsin people who appear mm-hmm. later on. And Hans Reese was at Columbia.
Indeed he was,
doing
yes.
Doing a postdoc at that point?
I believe so. He was with working with Arthur Pollister on the kind of work he's continued to do, ultrastructure, mm-hmm. electron microscopy, and doing very fine work then and thereafter.
Did you have any association with him?
Well, I knew him. We had some conversations. Mm-hmm. We were not close mm-hmm. personal acquaintances, but certainly very friendly. And he was among many people who were 5-10 years older than myself mm-hmm. who would look askance when they first met me, but mm-hmm. after they got used to my manners would accept me as a very, he certainly couldn't argue with my enthusiasm and eagerness mm-hmm. and involvement. And I think that was eventually win people over.
What about courses and instructors at Columbia? Were there any that any courses or instructors that particularly influenced you?
Well, I had one outstanding mentor, and that was Francis Ryan. I had come to Columbia knowing that there was a strong program in biology and genetics and cytology, but I didn't know any of the detail of what was there. So instead of E.B. Wilson, his successor was Franz Schrader. And so one of the first courses I took there was the general cytology mm-hmm. Course. That may have been where I met Hans. He might have been the instructor in that course or had some role with it. It would have been a very plausible thing for him to do. Well, Professor Schrader was a rather stiff, Germanic type. I wanted to do some experiments with mice, and he didn't like to have mice in the laboratory. And Salome Welsh, whose name you will have run into mm-hmm. elsewhere, mm-hmm. was also a research associate. There was severe discrimination against women in those days, and mm-hmm. he was one of the most outstanding people of her generation. Never got a tenure appointment at Columbia, but anyhow, she's told her own story elsewhere. And she befriended me, and but she's told me much later on one of the reasons she was so nice to me about giving me mice for me to do my experiments, that she knew that would infuriate Schrader. So. I was doing some studies on the effects of colchicine on spermatogenesis. In fact, I was trying to do a bit of genetic engineering. If one could suppress meiosis, you might get diploid spermatozoa, and if those fertilize the haploid egg, you could have a triploid animal. And I was really quite curious what that might look like. And for a whole lot of reasons, they did not in the end work out, although there was some good cytology in following what actually happened in spermatogenesis. Just 3 months ago, a paper was published that, in effect, reproduced the experiments that I had done at that time. So it wasn't a bad idea.
Now, in about 1943 to 45, as the war was going on, you served in the V-12 and hospital corps. Can we talk about that?
Well, let's back up a little bit. I entered Columbia in September 41. Was as a civilian. Of course, in December, we entered the war. We were in almost mm-hmm. the wartime footing even before then. Not long thereafter, the issue would come up about conscription and all the rest of it, although I was too young at the very beginning. The Navy advertised a officer training program called V-12, mm-hmm. and again, by competitive examination, if you entered the program, the Navy would put you in uniform and support your education, and you would have an obligation for service a little later on. So I qualified for that as a pre-med and then eventually medical student. Sometime in 42, I took the examinations and actually enrolled. Was not called to active duty until July 1st, 1943. So at that point, I was recruited into the Naval Service, but seconded immediately right back to Columbia College, which had a V-12 program, which was the understood intention. However, in early June, I got my orders, and they said, "You shall report to Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts, for your pre-medical training."
Uh-huh.
And I was resigned to it. I didn't know much was going on there. I was thinking of what else were the research institutions in Worcester, and there were one or two, and sort of wondering what was going to happen. And then happily found out it was a mistake. They'd cut the wrong orders, and I got the orders to go to Columbia.
So for the duration, you just...
So I stayed at Columbia, but the difference was instead of commuting from home, it was not a long commute, but I was then in uniform and in barracks on the Columbia campus from July 1, 43 on. So then, there I was under naval discipline and control and control of my curriculum. And from time to time, they decided that I didn't need to be in school for that quarter because I was accumulating enough credit, and I was not going to be admitted into medical school until October of 44. Mm-hmm. So I should do my bit for service, and that's where I was enrolled as a hospital corpsman in those intervals. And I was seconded to the Naval Hospital at St. Albans on a couple of occasions. It was on and off whether I'd be taking the obligatory courses at Columbia or serving as a corpsman. At the Naval Hospital, the job I was assigned to was in the clinical laboratory, and I became the parasitologist for the hospital. We had 3rd Marine Division back there in droves, a lot of them with malaria, some of them with other intestinal parasites, and my job was the laboratory diagnosis. And I did that very very cheerfully, and found it in many respects very interesting, and learned a lot in the process. I saw a lot of malaria. It's had a lot of influence the way I thought about life ever since.
I would imagine so.
Once in a while, I'd actually take care of patients. We'd have various watches for various kinds of duty, and they might involve some small modicum of patient care, but my main job was in the laboratory. But for more than one spell, I was also on the morgue watch, and that meant you were on call any time of the night. If we had a someone who died during the night, it was my job to help prepare the remains. So it was a diversified experience.
Yeah.
However, a lot of my buddies had been drafted into combat service and served many other places around the world, and I felt a great debt to them that they were making far more sacrifices than I was, and it's a sense of obligation I've had ever since. It's part of why I've stayed interested in security matters.
Mm-hmm. You graduated from Columbia then when?
So Columbia College, something like the following. I might have graduated in July, might have had a tour at St. Albans for a few months. Mm-hmm. Then I know I started at Columbia Medical School in October 1944.
Let's talk about your decision to go there first. Why? What was behind that? As opposed to going to...
Again, I didn't know how many opportunities I might have, and I thought as a Columbia undergraduate I would be have a little bit of an edge. That may have been right, it may not have been. But frankly, I don't recall if I'd even attempted any other college. But it was a school of very fine reputation. It was in the neighborhood I'd grown up in Washington Heights. Mm-hmm. I'd always longed at the idea that I might sometime be able to study there. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure I really pursued any alternatives. I'm not certain.
Were you planning on if you were thinking this way, were you planning on a career in practicing medicine or medical research? Or
well, I wasn't absolutely certain about that.
Sure?
I knew I wanted a strong research component. I would say that what I thought I was doing when I was entering medical school was preparing for practice and research in neurology. I felt that was the specialty that might have the greatest convergence.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it's true. There's so little you can do for...
Mm-hmm.
Neurological disorders that ipso facto it's very heavily laden, especially in those days, with research. I was quite fascinated with the functions of the brain and so on. Meantime, I had become deeply imbued with pursuing genetic work back at Columbia. And so in the event, I actually, while I was going to medical school, I was still working in Francis Ryan's laboratory in Morningside Heights. On the main Columbia campus. So let me go back to Francis.
Okay, yes, we were going.
He was away during my first year at Columbia. He was doing his postdoc experience with Beadle and Tatum out at Stanford. I heard about him. I heard about the work by Beadle and Tatum on biochemical mutants in Neurospora. I was turned on about that as soon as I ever heard about it. And knowing that Francis was there, the instant he returned, I camped on his doorstep and gave him no peace until he let me work in his laboratory. Well, he was the most important mentorial influence in my life from throughout my college days and beyond. So I spent much more time in his lab than I did anything else.
What did he do that was so important to you? What
He
mentoring?
Provided a lot of discipline. We exchanged ideas. He gave me a discipline about how to do experiments, how to record your results. really what it meant to confront a scientific issue in a highly professional way. And he had that role for any number of others. Mm-hmm. He died quite young, and the number of testimonials about his role as a teacher was absolutely legion. And,
another person who makes a brief entrance into your life later on, in terms of what we'll be talking about, is Kimball Atwood. Wasn't he a student of Ryan's as well?
He worked with Ryan. I don't think he ever studied with him. He, I think, was a Columbia undergraduate a few years before me. At any rate, he was at Columbia doing experimental work. At the same time, he was going to NYU Medical School. And at one point, we decided to share rooms, so we roomed together for quite a while. That would have been probably in late 1944, after I was a medical student. He was doing research on Drosophila cytogenetics at that time. Then later on, not during the time I was with Ryan, or it overlapped only briefly, later on he did work with Ryan on periodic selection in the chemostat and some other very fine experiments. Rather biophysically inclined, which had nothing to do with medicine. Mm-hmm. I never understood why he went to medical school. He had rather little interest in it, no intentions of using his medical education, and as far as I know, he never did. But anyhow, there he was.
Now, your first publication was with Ryan.
That's correct. It was on the work I assisted him with in Neurospora. So when he came back September of 42, I very promptly came into his lab, was his dishwasher and then lab mm-hmm. assistant. And then he gradually let me do more and more things mm-hmm. around the lab, including sharing ideas with him mm-hmm. on new experiments to do. So he had observed a phenomenon of what was called adaptation, leucine-requiring strains of Neurospora when planted on leucine-free media would not grow or grow to a very limited degree because they didn't have the leucine they needed to make their protein. But every now and then an event would occur whereby there would be an outgrowth of leucine-independent organisms that would grow very happily without leucine. And so the question is, was this really a reverse mutation? Mm-hmm. And while that seems very commonplace today, that was a new concept at that mm-hmm. time. So I was assigned the job of investigating, was it a reverse mutation? That basically involved doing back crosses between the adapted strains and the wild-type strains to make sure that there was no hidden leucine-dependent genetic material in those strains. And the answer was it wasn't. That the best we could tell, the adaptive change was a mutation in the same gene that had mutated in the first place. And there's no doubt of that today. I mean, this is the astonishment that people have is, did you ever even, was it ever problematic that there were reverse mutations? It's hard to avoid them in many other settings. So that was my first paper.
Hindsight is wonderful. Were there any other professors at the surgeon, physician and surgeon college?
Well, this is all Columbia College
that
I'm talking about.
Yeah.
No, I had much more personal, intimate relationships there than I did in medical school. Well, Dunn, Barth, were among the faculty present. They're the ones I remember most immediately. Pollister, there were a number of others. But Ryan was the one I spent most of my time with. At PNS, at Columbia Medical School, no one professor stands out. We were herded into very large lecture rooms. But I got to know David Rittenberg, David Schemin, Sam Graff, or a few of the folks. There were probably two or three others that I would get to schmooze with a little mm-hmm. bit. Mm-hmm. They knew I was interested in research, which was not the standard in those days for medical students. Excuse me a second.
Here, while you're here.
So most of my work in medical school was pretty didactic, and while it had the advantage of having a better organized library for scientific medical material than I had downtown, I didn't get it. I can't recall any deep intellectual relationships. It was also a rather different peer group. There were a bunch of smart people, but again, they were not primarily scientifically mm-hmm. oriented. They were going into practice careers and so forth. Mm-hmm. There are a few exceptions. There, Paul Marx, Mel Grumbach, Henry Scheinfeld, or people who've become very important in academic medicine were in my classes. But that was the exception rather than the rule.
What happened that caused you to take a leave from school and transfer to Yale?
Well, a couple of events. One, the war ended, and that opened up options for being a little bit more flexible in the pursuit of my medical education. Two, I'd already begun experiments. This is in 1945-46. I'd already begun experiments looking for recombination in bacteria. That was kind of an extrapolation from the work that I had done at Ryan's instance on the Neurospora reversions. That was also influenced by my having read the paper by Avery, McCarty, and McLeod on DNA causing genetic transformations in pneumococci. And the burning issue was, did that really represent transferring genes from one cell to another? Was DNA genes? And was very difficult to draw any very general conclusions from the one neuron.
So it seemed to you it was the most burning question?
Most burning question in biology was the authentication that a chemically defined substance was the carrier of genetic material and needed to be approached from a variety of perspectives. So at first I tried transforming Neurospora, doing the pneumococcus-style experiments with extracts of wild-type Neurospora and see if they would transform a leucine-dependent one.
Where did you try doing that?
In Ryan's laboratory, and with his strong encouragement. And he was the kind of person you could be, you'd never be sure where an idea came from. He just encouraged such a dialectic that he was not jealous at all in that regard, and that was one of the things that made him a wonderful teacher. But at any rate, extrapolated those experiments into one trying to transform Neurospora, one for a variety of technical reasons that didn't work, and there was no way we could have made it work in retrospect with the knowledge at that time. Then thought, well, maybe we can turn this around and see if bacteria can in fact exchange genetic material by mating, as do other organisms. Now, this was a no-no in the textbooks, but as I started looking into it, I realized that there was no intellectual foundation for the claim that bacteria were asexual, although that was the universal tradition. And I was reinforced on that very happily, a book by René Dubos, who had just left Rockefeller for Harvard. He was going to come back to Rockefeller again, called The Bacterial Cell, which was the first perspective of bacteriology from a general biological standpoint. The name tells you that already, thinking of bacteria as cells rather than as demons, rather than as germs, you know, sources of infection and so on. And he laid out the arguments pro and con sexuality, and he confirmed my inference that there was really no hard evidence one way or the other was a problem worth pursuing with powerful genetic methodology, which I had learned about from working with Ryan. So those experiments were underway. They had not given any very clear-cut results. So when the war ended, we were told we could have various options, and one option was an elective quarter, basically to give the faculty at the medical school a rest after the very strenuous wartime schedule.
Right, they were teaching.
So the war ended, as you know, in August 1945. We were demobilized in November. We're on our own financially, which was also a considerable strain at that stage. But anyhow, we had this opportunity, and so Francis suggested that I might think of working with Ed Tatum, who had just moved from Stanford to Yale. And very importantly, Ed had developed some strains of E. coli, some mutant strains, that would be ideal for the experiments that I was planning to do. So instead of just asking him for the strains, Francis suggested to Ed, why don't you take Josh Lederberg into your lab for a little while to do these experiments. I wrote a letter outlining the research proposal, which is the one that worked, and Ed accepted me. Negotiated time for my appearance, which would match when I had the elective quarter, was I think the 1st of April or middle of March 1946, which is when I arrived in New Haven and continued the experiments in Ed's lab in New Haven.
Let's, before we get into those, let's talk a little bit about Tatum and his background. Mm-hmm. Now, he was from Wisconsin. He had received his PhD. As a matter of fact, he'd grown up in Wisconsin.
Yes, his father was a very distinguished professor of pharmacology in the medical school, Arthur Tatum. Mm-hmm. I didn't know much about this at that time. Of course, when I came to Madison, the traditions were very clearly drawn for me. But so this is not necessarily information I knew when I was coming to see him in New Haven. But he had indeed grown up there. He had done all of his academic work as an undergraduate, as a graduate student. He had worked with Fred and Peterson for his doctoral work, which is on nutrition and lactobacilli. Mm-hmm. He was one of the very early people to discover bacteria that needed vitamins for their growth. And these in turn became very important assay tools for measurement of vitamin concentration in foods and other places. That was the general arena of his work. Also the metabolism of lactic acid and propionic acid bacteria. So he worked in a strong tradition along those lines. Ez Snell was a graduate student at around the same time. Marv Johnson might have been a young instructor. I think he was a year or two ahead of Ed. So a lot of names that you're very well acquainted with were part of his ambiance. Mm-hmm. He was doing a postdoc after he completed his graduate work with Fritz Kergel in Utrecht on the nutrition of fungi, and received word, I don't know who had commended Tatum to Beadle, but Beadle was starting a program of research on the biochemistry of eye colors in Drosophila, working out their genetic control and the gene-enzyme relationship in 1936, 37. And in 37, he ended up recruiting Ed to come to Stanford to be the biochemist to work out pathways of eye pigment biosynthesis. This had nothing immediately to do with Ed's background in microbial nutrition, but the latter had everything to do with the transition to research on Neurospora, which Beadle, having gotten very discouraged by the complexities of working with eye pigments, decided to shift to that. And Ed's background on nutritional requirements of fungi fitted perfectly into that scheme. So in January or February 41, they started their experiments on looking for biochemical mutants in Neurospora. And by June or July, they already had a whole passel of them, and they published their first report in October or November in the PNAS, so that was very, very quick breakthrough. Anyhow, that was Ed's background.
What compelled him to come to Yale again?
Again, opportunity. He was a very junior faculty member. He was a chemist, and I have some letters in my files about Van Neel bewailing the fact that there was a lot of prejudice against chemists in biology departments.
Why?
Well, they were a new breed. I mean, read E.O. Wilson about Jim Watson at Harvard, and you'll get latter-day images of the same thing. So he was having a tough time progressing academically. So at a point at which Stanford had refused him promotion to an associate professor, Yale offered him a full professorship. Wow. So that's why he and set up his program, and then I was one of his early recruits.
And then along, and so it was just
a few years later, Stanford begged for him to come back. So,
so it was just good luck on your part that he happened to.
Exactly, I was one of the few people who just matched his. I think he was only there for a couple of years, 3-4 years at the most, at Yale before he went back to Stanford.
So let's talk about your collaboration with Tatum and your research. Your groundbreaking research.
Well, I'd come to that lab with a prepared proposal and a definite protocol for what experiments.
And you're how old at this point?
1946, so I was 21.
21.
So that part was fairly cut and dry. I knew what I wanted to do, and Ed had the right strains for it. But there was a lot of other know-how. I just picked up a lot of elements, mostly of technique, from working with Ed about how to do experiments. He was a very insightful investigator. He had a green thumb, I had a reputation for being pretty careless with glassware, and I suppose there must have been some truth with it. It was not intentional, believe me, but I was too eager. I was too impulsive. I was just, you know, being rush from one place to another, and should have calmed down a little bit. Things would have gone more smoothly. At any rate, it was only about 6 weeks from the time I started to the time the experiments worked. And did them again and again and again. And having arrived there, checked the dates, but I think it was the 1st of April. Mm-hmm. By the 1st of July, I was ready to talk about them. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity for that came about with the Cold Spring Harbor Symposium. Mm-hmm. That was being held in early July of 1946. Ed was on the program. I begged to be allowed to attend. I didn't think we were going to talk about the experiments, but then Al Hershey talked about recombination and bacteriophage, and a lot of other people were bewailing, isn't it too bad that bacteria don't do things like that? And we just felt we just couldn't
can't sit on
keep it quiet
like that
anymore, even though it was still fairly early. But the fact of the matter is, I couldn't think of another experiment to do that would nail it down any further than we had.
And you were confident that you would have the results, that you were confident enough to go in front
of this group? The first time, but after 15 times, yes. Mm-hmm. So I knew I had a reproducible phenomenon. I'd done experiments with more and more markers, had clear segregation of unselected as well as selected markers. There was just no doubt about it. I mean, and the wonderful thing is you could do these experiments overnight, so it was... when I say 20 experiments, it took a month.
That's right. That's the advantage of working with a
So Ed agreed, and so he managed to wangle a time on the program, which was not on the listed program. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't have a record of what date that was. Yeah. And there was a great debate, but I've written that up in an article about the disputation. Avuff was my main contender, because he was representing organized skepticism perfectly appropriately, just trying to find loopholes. He didn't feel I'd plugged them. I was certain that I had. Mm-hmm. And it isn't that I hadn't thought about them. I'd thought of more loopholes than anybody at the meeting, a lot that were not brought up.
Did you just give an informal presentation? How did that...
No, it was fairly formal. I mean, I was just given some time on the program, but then there was an informal post-session seminar. A number of people wanted to hear more about it, so that lasted 3 or 4 hours, sort of nonstop.
Wow.
And that's where, you know, LaVeouf, et cetera, had some argument. He thought that I had not proven, here's where Maxelli will come in a minute. Okay. LaVeouf thought had not proven that I'd really gotten single cells that had the characters of the two parental cells, and that I was just dealing with contaminated mixed cultures that were cross-feeding each other. And he just, that was the first thing I was worried about, and I was designing my experiments to make sure that I wouldn't be confused with that. I spent a lot of time and effort to cover that base, and I think in retrospect, without reservation. But had trouble convincing him. Then eventually, LaVeouf would say, you have to isolate single cells, and I would say, it's superfluous. Here's all this other evidence that these are pure clones and that they can't possibly be mixtures. And he would say, I won't believe until you've isolated single cells. So then Max Zilli raised his hand. He said, look, Josh, we'll if you want, I'll show you how to do it, or we'll do it together. We'll isolate single cells and we'll satisfy LaVeouf on this point. So that's exactly what happened. I had overestimated how difficult the technique it was, and it's actually quite simple to do, and I've done it routinely many hundreds of times since, getting single cells under the microscope. So that's where he entered the picture on this score. I had no idea he was going to be a contender for a job that I didn't know existed. So
not too many years after that.
Well, the next year.
Next year,
So anyhow, that was summer of 1946, and those experiments were working so well, and it was obvious that they were striking a chord in the community. And 90% of the people I talked to did buy it. The main holdout was the Caltech group, and Delbrück in particular expressed great skepticism.
What did he express skepticism about?
He says I didn't do the experiments he would have wanted me to do, and he didn't even want to discuss it until I had done those. I mean, he didn't want to hear my evidence. He had his own.
And he was doing research on viruses.
On phage, not on bacteria. So. Luria, I think having Delbruck in mind, sent me a cartoon that offered very great encouragement for not to be too... too intimidated by the old fogies.
Well, you were definitely the young Turk at that point.
So, and there were a lot of people like that. You can't believe how warm and helpful all the big names in the field were to me as a young kid. They saw the evidence. Some of them couldn't be sure. The ones who weren't working immediately with bacteria didn't feel that they would know enough about all the technical lurks that might be there, but it was really laid out very carefully, and anyone who had been imbued with being a geneticist in that style of thinking, there was no escape. Mm-hmm. So, and Kurt Stern told me that the only time in his life he'd ever accepted a paper for genetics on his own recognizance without sending out the review was the one I sent him. He said it was inescapable. So.
You said, I read somewhere, you said that this experiment could have been done 50 years earlier.
Technically, it could have, but there wasn't the right approach about thinking about bacteria as genetic entities. The less, as time went on, I think when Mendelism first burst on the world in the 1900s, that might have been a very good opportunity to think what is the zone of its application. And the person, if he weren't doing some other important things that I would have fingered as... a very good candidate is Beyerinck, who knew about Mendel's work. In fact, it was his reprint. He had a copy of the Mendel paper, which is the one that de Vries later read, and was part of the rediscovery of Mendelism in 1900. Mm-hmm. And Beyerinck did write a few papers on mutation in bacteria, but he never brings up the concept of recombination. Mm-hmm. But why not?
Yeah.
And he knew enough about selective enrichment, he might have thought of putting it together in that way. So that's a sense in which it could have happened. Now, I think if there were as many microbiologists in 1946 as there were in 1900, it would have happened. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is that the field was not that thickly covered with people looking for problems, looking for things to do, quite the other way around.
When you started this experiment, were you confident it was going to work?
Oh, no. I had no idea it was going to work or not. Just wanted to test the proposition. Mm-hmm. And I was prepared for a long haul. I mean, I was quite startled when it worked right off the bat, the first strains I worked on. And that was pure luck.
Tell me about that.
I didn't know how lucky I was in coming to Tatum, because not only did he have interesting mutants, the very strain that he had chosen, E. coli K12, which is just one of the stock culture collections out of Stanford, proves to be fortuitously almost unique in a number of properties to lend itself to this kind of experimentation. So one thing after another kept popping out of the hat as a result of working with this particular strain, and I would never have had any encounter with it. It wasn't the one that Ed had. He'd picked out in the dark. And
so if you picked out another one, you might have given up after a...
Retrospectively, for the way we did the experiment, and actually the way it was conducted, if random strains had been chosen, there was one chance in 20 that they would have worked. Would I have pushed it? I was well aware of the prospects of strain specificity. In fact, for all I knew, there were male strains and female strains, and I would have to mix them with the right gender combinations. We were working totally in the dark. So I was quite startled when it did work right off the bat with a single strain. I didn't need to mix strains of different origin. And whatever. How far I was prepared to go if it hadn't worked the first time around, I have no idea. I assume I would have tried a few more, but would I have done enough more to beat the statistical odds? I just don't know. Just don't know.
You understood the enormity of what you'd done when you did it?
I think so. I didn't. Yes, I did, because I linked it to the enormity of what Avery and his people had done. That was the enormous thing that had happened in biology, in my view, and I had just tackled one particular niche in that overall complex. That's what we call molecular biology today. But I was a genetic counterpart to their biochemical work. I mean, if you read their papers, they're not that deep into genetics, and that's what I had read very, very deeply during my studies. So that's what I complimented.
Now, this was published, the results were published in initially.
Well, the first appearance in print was in Nature, because Ed and I knew it was going to take months and months before the proceedings of the Cold Spring Harbor Symposium would be out. We knew there would be rumors, so we thought we'd better. So we sent an article into Nature that was published in November, I believe, 46, a very brief note summarizing what we had already spoken about at Cold Spring Harbor. And then sometime in the spring of 47, the proceedings of the Cold Spring Harbor were also published. So those are the first two appearances. Then shortly thereafter, I mean, to be very clear about it, Ed himself did none of the experiments. I did every single one of the experiments in the lab. I had brought the concept of the experiment to the lab. He had provided the strains. He had provided a lot of guidance, oversight, gave me the lab space. We talked over the results, and we reviewed the manuscripts together. So
did you do the writing, basically, for the manuscripts?
I did the preliminary writing, and then Ed would polish it up. And so it was completely appropriate that we be joint authors. I would have been bizarre not to have included him in any way, but it was also appropriate that we alternated senior authorship for the first couple of papers, and then after that, I think Ed never published anything else on recombination in bacteria.
When you were first setting up the experiment, talking to Dr. Tatum, did he think it was going to work? Did he have confidence in it? Did he have expressed that?
I don't think that was the issue. The issue is, did we have a good experimental test, and we were going to find out something about Nature one way or the other by applying that test. So in that sense, we thought it was going to work. It would answer the question, can one find genetic recombination in bacteria? A very powerful test for it. Whether the phenomenon actually existed, nobody could, there was no basis for any prior inference. Well, there was a little one. You know, why wouldn't one guess that it might happen? I had one thing in the back of my mind. I'm going to get out. Hold on a second. Okay. The issue was, there having been no authentic description of conjugational phenomena, and nobody in natural history had seen any clear evidence of reassortment of genes, is there anything else in the natural history of bacteria that might lead one to guess whether recombination is occurring? I was led on to this by a few pages in DuBose's book, and I'm looking right now at a book that I bought in 1945.
There it is.
In Germany. It's by Fritz Kaufmann. It's Die Bakteriologie der Salmonella Gruppe, the bacteriology of the Salmonella group. It had been published in 1941, and I notice an amusing point. It was reprinted, copyright vested in the alien property custodian pursuant to law, because this originally had been published in Denmark, and of course they'd been occupied by the Germans. So it was a book that others felt was important enough that it should be made available to the scientific community in the United States. This is a systematic overview of the various serological types as they exist in natural isolates of different Salmonella strains. And if you look at tables of these types, I don't know if he has it organized in this way. Yes, here we go. Yeah, the H and the O. What you find is that when you do serological typing of all of these different, they were then called species of Salmonella, it just hit you between the eyes that they were all different combinations of a somatic antigen on the one hand and a flagellar antigen on the other. So there indeed was some natural historical suggestion that some kind of reassortment of immunogenic factors was taking place within the Salmonella group. So that was the only hint. It's a valid hint. I think this is indeed a correct explanation of what we see in the natural occurrence of these strains, but probably more by genetic transduction by viruses than by cellular conjugation. That was about all there was. There's no other bacterium had its natural history studied in such depth that you could look to see for different groups of characters whether they appeared to reassort with one another. So that was the feeble thread. But this, by the way, was the reason that the next organism after E. coli that I wanted to study was salmonella. I didn't do salmonella first because it is a pathogen and one has to use somewhat more care in dealing with it in the laboratory than with garden variety E. coli mm-hmm. strains.
Let's get back to Yale now. So at this point, you're deciding not to go back to medical school.
Okay, where are we now? Summer of 1946.
Right.
These experiments have been working beautifully. I do want to get after answering Leveuf's objections. The whole field of bacterial genetics opening up. Yeah. What are you going to do with this methodology? The main lines are one to extend it to other organisms and use it, the other to do genetic analysis of important genetic physiological problems. So there was an infinity of things to do. I mean, indeed it is. I mean, there have been 25 or 35,000 papers published on E. coli K12 since then. So it would have been stupid for me to turn my back on that at that stage. And I asked for another year's leave of absence from medical school in order to pursue it at least that much further. So that was the year I spent working out the linkage map of E. coli and published that in Genetics, I think in 48, the work I'd done during 47. So continued in that fashion. Another minor incident, I met Esther Zimmer and we married in December 46. She was also working in another laboratory, but we were both very tolerant of what it meant to do laboratory work since we were both mm-hmm. doing it. So we were pretty busy.
What about Tatum? Did you work with him anymore after that initial experiment?
Well, during the time I was at Yale, I was under his supervision.
Were
so
okay.
That was my status there. And and he was extraordinarily helpful, indispensable in making all the arrangements. I mean, he got the fellowship that enabled me to come to New Haven in the first place. I was the first fellow of the Childs Fund
for really?
Medical research.
Jane Clough
and Childs, right. And then arranged a renewal of that for the following year. Some pretty insightful people to recognize that this was work worth supporting. And just in every other way, I mean, I could not imaginably have done my experiments without his deep involvement and spending a lot of time and effort at it. But he was not immediately involved in the experimental work, and I would say not even really very much in the intellectual work. Ed was much more of a biochemist than a geneticist. He wasn't thinking about mapping. He wasn't. He was concerned about gene-enzyme relationships, but the things he knew how to do were to isolate enzymes, isolate biochemical intermediates, work out chemical pathways. And that in itself was an astounding discovery. I mean, that's what I've marked as being mm-hmm. the important contribution that Beadle and Tatum made. They didn't really discover biochemical genetics, but they established the paradigm of pathway analysis by using mutants that block a pathway. So you end up with a deficiency of the end product, which you may have to feed from the outside for the organism to grow, and you get an accumulation of intermediate products as they're piled up behind an enzymatic step that's been chopped out so they can't be converted to something else. So that's been the basic paradigm of how you do pathway analysis in every field. So. But anyhow, that was his forte, and that was his line of thinking.
You got your PhD, you wrote your dissertation pretty much on your experiments, or you compiled your dissertation?
My dissertation was a compilation of the work that I'd already done. It didn't even come up until rather late in 1947 when the new crisis was, well, do I go back to medical school or what do I do? And at some point during that summer, Ed had received a solicitation from Brink asking about people for a job that was to be filled at the University of Wisconsin.
In May of 47, that was.
I would have guessed to be about that, yeah. And I don't know when Ed told me about that, but at any rate, he did put my name in to Brink and sent in some background material. And it probably wasn't until June or July that I was personally contacted.
July.
It was July. And that issue began to warm up and became a matter of more urgent decision. It was around that time that Ed suggested that if you're going to think about taking a position elsewhere, you better get your doctoral degree taped down. And so he worked out another coup with the Yale authorities, and that was to arrange for me to register retrospectively as a graduate student. So all the time I was there, I was in an informal status as a visiting medical student from Columbia. So got that fixed up, and the big almost showstopper was the $800 tuition fee I had to find somewhere or other in order to complete the retroactive registration.
$800?
$800.
Wow. You know what that. Let's talk briefly a little bit more about your experiment with Dr. Tatum. How did you feel about it?
When the first positive results came in, I think fear was probably my dominant emotion. It was fear of having my expectations aroused only to be dashed later on by finding out with some artifact. So I was really trying very hard not to get too excited about it, to be restrained, to assume that it was probably a mistake or an artifact, and not sink my hopes on it. And I was especially fearful that my judgment might be clouded by those kinds of expectations. And I'd suggest that that's probably quite appropriate for anyone else facing that kind of a situation.
That's a good, And then you eventually knew that it was indeed.
After repeating it four or five times, there was no escaping it. And so then start to think about its implications. And then what do you do next? What is the next most important experiment that would have to be done? And I was eager to talk about it to others and get their inputs and ideas and suggestions, and indeed did do that. The Cold Spring Harbor Symposium was a wonderful opportunity because here was essentially everybody in the field congregated for the first time since the war. And it was important in two ways. One, the substantive content that I had of supportive and critical judgments made by people whom I respected very, very deeply. Their rather nurturing stance that they took in many respects, but also that the debate was all laid out there, and it settled the matter once and for all. If this had been merely published in the general literature, people reading these articles might invent all kinds of things that had not been thought about or that they thought were not thought about. Having it hashed out in public with the discipline of everybody seeing it, you couldn't complain later on that it is wrong when you had been there and had every opportunity to indicate what your objections were. So it produced a very useful and constructive crisis in the reception and the treatment of that material. Harriet Zuckerman's pointed this out to me. I didn't have that sense of it at the time, how very lucky I was to have that particular kind of opportunity. On a matter as controversial as this.
And you had been sitting on it, like you said, up till that point. The people there did not know, or did?
Oh, there was no inkling of it until we announced it.
Wow.
Well, we didn't want rumors to be floating around without the full and detailed data. And there was a question of when did we feel confident enough that the data would support the rumor. So.
Let's go to your next opportunity, which was the job that we talked about, referred to on the last tape at the University of Wisconsin. Tatum had been contacted by Dr. Brink, who was chairman of the genetics department out of the College of Ag at the University of Wisconsin, and you were subsequently let in on it. It turns out that the position was to fill the retirement of Leo J. Cole, and they decided to go to somebody who would do more theoretical genetics, is that?
Or basic genetics, yes.
Do you know why that decision was made?
No, so it was probably Cole's own influence, and that to some degree I was an heir to his own position there. That's probably not quite right, because he had always emphasized the practical applications of genetics as well. But what I'd heard about them still supports that to some degree, that he was very mindful of the importance of genetics as an intellectual discipline, its role in general biology, as well as its applications.
Now, you were not the only person solicited by Brink. You, of course, didn't know
that. Of course, I didn't know that.
Time,
yeah.
Right, of course not. But some of the other people were Max
Zelli,
and John Lockman, Adrian Serb, A.H. Dorman, and David Regnery?
Regnery.
Regnery.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit about what you know about those gentlemen?
Well, some of them I knew very well. Dave Regnery ended up at Stanford, was on the faculty there for some time. Adrian Serb went to Cornell, had a very distinguished career in Neurospora genetics. Gus Dorman did some very fine work on T phages. I think he had done some Neurospora work as well. Max Zelli is a little bit surprising. I don't think he made that strong a mark scientifically. Well, I think he came into some fairly important administrative positions in biology and medicine in the AEC. John Lawn is one of the outstanding maize geneticists of this generation, so they were formidable people.
Okay.
Ed Tatum, at that point, was telling me a lot of things about Wisconsin and how much he'd enjoyed living there. I knew nothing of it. Mm-hmm. I'd never been in the Midwest up to that point. And I knew none of the people that I was going to see there. Was very thrilled and excited about the idea of the interview.
Mm-hmm. Were there many jobs in that area?
There were no other jobs in that area. That was the whole point. I mean, the choice between taking this job and going back to medical school was going back to medical school and not being sure that there was going to be another job in this area mm-hmm. in the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. That may seem ludicrous today
in
the hottest part of biological research, but that's the way it was at that time. It was presented to me, I think, fairly realistically as a unique opportunity, and I was really making a choice not just about that one job, but it would have ended up as the alternative going through the medical pathway.
It was a
very tough call.
Yeah. Did you talk to Brink over the phone? Was there any kind of communication?
I don't think so. I don't recall it.
You were just instructed to come to Madison. What was it August 20th through 23rd, 1947? Were the days they set up? Mm-hmm. And I think it was arranged like a month before, and it was for that fall semester, correct?
Well, I've forgotten when the seminar was that I was to present.
It was probably the 23rd of August,
It was
during that time.
Okay. So I was still not clear that I was going to be offered the job, mm-hmm. But they obviously needed to interview me first before they could make up their mind about it.
So you took a trip there. How did you get to Madison?
As my records indicate, by railroad.
the
New York.
Did you go with your
New York Central.
Or?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. I think many people did comment what an asset she was to my credibility. There are many very commendable remarks about her in the correspondence. But, it may have made a 21 or 22-year-old a little bit more credible
that he was already
a settled married man.
Yes, let's remember that. You're still only 21 or 22 years old. Do you remember much about the interview? It's the interview process
itself. No, I can't recall it.
What were your first impressions of the Midwest?
Very friendly people, and I thought correctly it was a place I could learn to enjoy very much. We were greeted very warmly by mm-hmm. everyone we saw. We knew we were being looked over. There was no question about that. But something that, the Wisconsin stereotype is really quite right, of very congenial, friendly, easygoing kind of outlook. And that came through at the very beginning.
Do you remember your initial impressions of Brink?
Just a very responsible, formidable, at first somewhat stiff personality, but, in half an hour that would mm-hmm. be very much dissipated. So I liked him right away.
And the campus, I'm trying to imagine it at that point in time, you were out, genetics was out, where
it's on Egg Hill.
What was your impression of the facility? Now, one of the things that Brink said to all the candidates is, he said, "Well, the lab isn't quite up to; it's nowhere near where we want it to be. You'll have to be patient on that account."
I was somewhat dismayed by the lab facilities, and given some expectations of improvement, which I don't think anyone actively misled me, but we were working in very primitive quarters mm-hmm. for quite a long time, longer, I think, than anybody had expected when we first arrived. But I think there wasn't too much realism in the department, since most of the work of the department involved a lot of field work. The laboratory was the acreage, and as there was no chemical experimentation going on inside the lab, I think nobody there really knew very well what to expect.
Yes, we have to remember that genetics was in the College of Agriculture.
That's correct.
So you were sort of a new breed right
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Now, I had my own questions about what it would mean working in that context. I was not the least bit dismayed about mixing applied orientations with basic research. And the university and the College of Agriculture already had a fabulous reputation, well-earned, in this field. I knew a fair bit about its work in nutrition and the work in enzymology up in the Bacti department and so on. So I knew that I'd have plenty of intellectual companionship, even if I was on the basic side of the spectrum, then much more even than today, about what was going on there. And it was the manifest interest that the people there were interested in the stories I had to tell, and in discussing their implications and so on, that became obvious right away.
Well, the College of Ag was the big college at that
That's
point.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Did you meet Ira Baldwin and E.B. Fred on that trip, do you recall?
I can't remember who I met at which
point.
And
you gave a seminar on, what was it, genetic recombination in E.
Yeah, you know,
sure.
Which
is pretty...
No, it would have been the work I'd been doing for the last year and a half.
Anything about that you recall?
No.
Okay. At what point did you decide that you wanted the job in Madison?
I think I could say I wanted the job in Madison as soon as we were greeted there.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that would be the final choice dependent on a lot of other matters, because I was still torn about going back finishing my medical mm-hmm. studies. You don't always get what you want.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to make choices. I don't think I made a final choice up till the very last moment, but other things had been percolating. I had applied for a Merck fellowship that would have provided financial support for my time in Madison, and indeed it almost at the last minute, the Jane Coffin Childs Fund said they would arrange some funds.
Hmm.
But as I recall, that would have been really a starvation diet.
Hmm.
But perhaps not totally impossible. But it would, in effect, have meant just that. And I was disappointed when I learned that I did not get the Merck Fellowship. I knew that the
you Beetle... You learned that before you come to Madison?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know the time, but it ties into the time when I was discouraged about the prospects of going back to medical school. If I could have done it and been able to... use my free time to do research and continue my work on E. coli, I thought it might have been feasible. So the idea would be I would come back to Ryan's laboratory, my research, and then continue my medical studies otherwise. Without an adequate fellowship, I would have had to work mm-hmm. during those hours, and I didn't know that was, if it wasn't going to be doing that research, whether that was really an acceptable or wise thing to do. So this is what I was balancing. So I didn't make up my mind until I told Brink I would do it. So
was Brink the one who offered you the job?
Maybe it was Irwin. I'm not sure.
Was it while you were in Madison that you were offered?
Well, I don't remember it, but from the correspondence, it would seem as if I had verbally agreed to it, and then it was followed up by a letter from them, to which I
and
then
your
replied.
Your salary was going to be 35, was it?
35, 3600, yeah.
Did you negotiate at all, or did you?
No.
Yeah. And it was primarily...
It was twice what I was making as a fellow, so...
Seemed like a lot of money. It was a research position, correct?
It was an assistant professorship. I was expected to teach and do research.
Okay. Did you teach in your first couple of years?
Oh, yeah. I started a course in genetics and microorganisms.
Oh, that's right.
It ended up being, quote, given alternate years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I did some of the lectures and a few other courses mm-hmm. besides the one I was primarily mm-hmm. responsible for. And that was cross-listed with bacteriology, by the way.
what you didn't know at the time, what was going on in the background while the hiring, while the people were looking for candidates and discussing your possible hire, is that some of the people on campus and some of the people who were written, who wrote letters concerning you, were concerned about, first of all, your youth, mm-hmm. which is certainly understandable, some by the fact that you were unfamiliar with farms and agriculture, which is reasonable for someone from New Jersey / New York, others with your personality, which some viewed as too aggressive, and still others, unfortunately, seemed troubled by the fact that you were Jewish. On the other hand, you had people like Brink and Baldwin defending you. Were you aware of any of this kind of stuff?
No, I was totally unaware of that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are remarks that take Lederberg in from the correspondence, which I've seen subsequently, take Lederberg in spite of his race. He may be a good guy anyhow, or he's smart enough to make up for his other defects.
Yeah.
Is roughly the tenor of it. But I'll just give this credit to congeniality, to decency. As I now know in retrospect, I think a lot of people whom I encountered daily who must have had some misgivings about taking a Jew onto the campus never betrayed that to me, dealt with me completely cordially. You know, I may not have always been, you know, welcomed with open arms and a personal friendly relationship, but I was never aware of that. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to do with the difference between stereotypes and people. I think anybody who knew me forgot whether I was Jewish or not. Or if they did, were decent enough not to have it intrude on that relationship. Yet these stereotypes were still there, and it was just a question of getting through them.
Also, the fact, the comments that you were perhaps too aggressive, I read in some of the correspondence that some of the people said that your aggressiveness came from the fact that you were so enthusiastic about what you were doing. Does that sound,
the aggressiveness was my relentlessness about the logic of mm-hmm. a situation, and I was not always diplomatic about that. When somebody was speaking nonsense, I would show it up. That's a fault. I could have learned sooner. I think I eventually did that. There are other ways to get that point across. But I could take as well as I could give, I guess, is the important point. And I didn't perhaps always realize that that was not enough. I expected to be dealt with critically, openly, forcefully, have my errors pointed out or argued about, and I had no hesitation about doing this with others, and that isn't everybody's style, and does one always have to be relentless? I think it's a very reasonable question, but I think in the context of scientific discussion, I thought it was appropriate to be. I thought that's what doing science would be all about. So that was, I believe, most of the aggressiveness that was being talked about. You didn't dare make a mistake in my presence because I would pounce on you, okay? Well, that could be to a fault. Mm-hmm. I can sympathize with people being put off by that.
Well, you're at Wisconsin now. Let's leave you there, and we'll pick this interview up the next time I come to New York.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We're going to add just a little postscript here.
I've been reflecting about these remarks about my personality and how I was so aggressive and so forth. As I look back on my relationships with the University of Wisconsin and how things might have worked out constructively better than they did, it was probably that I was not aggressive enough, that I endured limitations of space, primarily facilities and some help. I was certainly, nothing was held back in terms of promotion, and I never complained about salary or anything of that sort, but just resources and the opportunity to actually do my work. I did not push hard enough. I took no for an answer the first time. There were many others on campus who did not do that, were more diligent in pressing for what they really wanted and had that out front. Instead, I just rather meekly accepted it the way it was. And the net result was, instead of being aggressive, I ended up leaving and going to other places where I didn't have to argue that hard about the things that I would want. I have to say the same thing about my time at Stanford, that I was not aggressive enough as well. And anyhow, so much for that. It's in a different sphere of aggressiveness.